Rural America has gotten a lot of political attention this year, with both parties picking vice presidential candidates they hope will appeal to rural Midwestern voters.
But author Sarah Smarsh says there's a problem. She says both parties and a lot of the media are working from oversimplified stereotypes.
On Tuesday, Sarah will give a public lecture in Spring Green as part of UW-Madison's Moral Lecture Series about misconceptions surrounding rural America.
Sarah Smarsh is a Midwestern journalist, author, and podcaster. Her books include Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Her new book comes out next month. It's called Bone of the Bone, Essays on America by a Daughter of the Working Class. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you're coming to Wisconsin in just a bit. Can you give us a preview of what you'll be talking about in this lecture by Spring Green there?
Of course. I'm so excited to be coming to the area. And to be honest, I'm not sure the last time I was in Wisconsin for an event. So because we are on the kind of on-ramp to a little current event you might have heard about called the presidential election, I hope to offer attendees of the event a kind of alternative to the pat political binaries and frameworks that are, to my mind, reductive and even dangerous in the way that we talk about the American electorate, not to mention our own hearts and minds as human beings who are processing all of this. So as a woman who hails from white working class rural America, I hope to engage folks in a dialogue about nuance and complexity and humanity in the midst of these inhumane political experiences we're having.
Yes, Sarah, a running theme through so much of your work, I think, is that we have these really simplistic stereotypes, we being the media, politicians across the political spectrum, pop culture, these really simplistic stereotypes of what rural America is, what the heartland is. What do you see as some of the worst of that, some of the worst stereotypes that really mislead us in understanding the heartland?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, any stereotype of a particular group or demographic is dangerous. The one that I can speak to directly and firsthand, as you note, is being from Midwestern farm country, essentially, the easy association or presumption that, let's say, a member of the white working class or a person from rural America would have a deeply conservative and even today far-right worldview is not only inaccurate, while it might hold up if you're just looking at those very clunky and, as you say, simplistic red and blue maps of regions or states or even counties. The truth on the ground, of course, is much more complex than that. And all of those places have large political minorities who are consequential and worth discussing and acknowledging, even though they're often kind of erased by winner-take-all politics.
You've written critically of different political parties and how they talk about rural areas, the heartland. I want to start with the Democratic Party. I think an accusation that's been made, and you could say if you think it's fair or not, is that at some point, Democrats have written off rural America, saying, well, they are conservative, maybe at worst, backward, outside of the vision we're looking for. Do you think that you've seen that happen among Democrats? Do you see that changing in any way?
I certainly think that's a fair criticism of that party for decades, and I'd say the duration of my lifetime. I was born in 1980, so kind of the dawn of the Reagan era, and growing up during the what was then called the farm crisis, sort of coming to a head with farm foreclosures in the 1980s, being growing in a space that was in many ways economically dying because of largely policy that favored big corporations. That was, by the way, the fault of both major parties. But when we're looking at this, the matter of who's at least paying attention, Democrats, I think, largely thought it'd be more efficient to just not put our resources there and go after the cities. And that is really a losing battle in terms of long-term sustainability of winning politically.
And meanwhile, Republicans have been accused of appealing maybe to the worst of rural America, to yes, pay attention, but to lead with a divisive message. It's rural against cities. Maybe it's poor and working class white people against white elites or minority groups or things like that. Do you see some reality to that accusation?
100%. And I do let my flag fly as a progressive in my writing. My politics are pretty clear, and I'm native to the white working class and still live in rural America. And so for me, the appeal from the right to that space that I come from is in the most malicious and manipulative manner, and then from the Democratic Party, just sort of an absence of attention altogether. So for me, and I do feel confident, many people in that space who have felt either ignored by one side or missed by another side, or let's say even perhaps insulted if you're of my political persuasion, it's really been a kind of where are we in national discourse? And I do think, and I wrote about this just last week for the New York Times, the tapping of Tim Walz for the vice presidential running mate with Kamala Harris was a really good sign in the right direction. He's very much from the same neck of the woods as I am, small town Nebraska himself, and I think has some real working class bona fides that will allow them to speak directly to a contingent who has felt ignored by that side of the aisle for some time.
I wanted to ask you about vice presidential candidates, because I think in each party, there's a choice here, consciously, I think, to pick a candidate that at least they think will appeal to the heartland, rural America, the Midwest, or whatever shorthand you want to use. What do you make of that coming from both parties?
Well, you know, my book, Heartland, came out in 2018, and that was a couple years after a book you might have heard of called Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Mm-hmm. Vance. And I was asked on many occasions to kind of weigh in about him and that book. And I largely kind of stayed off that. For one, I didn't want it to seem that my own work was somehow derivative. I was working on my book long before I think he ever, paused from his time as a venture capitalist to pen his memoir. Now, I will say that his political leanings and what he has done with his social capital tracks with the red flags that I was seeing when that book first came out. And when, frankly, a lot of even liberal media outlets were giving him a platform and anointing him in ways that I felt were quite problematic and maybe playing into their own classist biases about the demographic he claimed to represent. He doesn't represent the white working class, which is not a monolith. He certainly does not speak for my family or the people in my community with his politics. And I think that it's a craven and cynical move to, hold him up as some sort of poster boy for millions and millions of people who, to my mind, his book largely cast a negative judgment against. And I should say, by the way, that I'm largely, like many of my Kansas brothers and sisters, really think of myself as kind of independent in a lot of ways. I'm not a big fan of our two-party system, so I'm by no means like a Democratic Party booster. I will say that Tim Walz strikes me as an authentic and real representative of a complicated space where people have real needs, and let's talk about policies that put food into children's bellies and favor the small working man and woman in their day-to-day struggles. And so I think the Democrats have a winning strategy and pick there.
Talking to Sarah Smarsh, author of books including Heartland and the forthcoming Bone of the Bone, Essays on America by a Daughter of the Working Class. Sarah is speaking in Spring Green in a few days. We'll give more details on that appearance in just a bit. Sarah, I want to talk about your writing. It's journalistic writing, but it's also you very much rely on the first person, your personal experiences and anecdotes. Why is that important to you in your work?
Well, Rob, I started out as a reporter, kind of traditional, just stick to the facts, cover everything from the city council to the night cops beat and maybe some arts and cultural pieces thrown in. At some point, I started writing essays that were definitely still addressing public issues much larger than my own life, but using my life and my family as a sort of springboard or vehicle to get at those ideas in more intimate ways. The reason I made that move is because every newsroom I worked in, I found I was the only person who had direct experience of either rural life or even more certainly poverty. And so as folks from marginalized identities often find themselves doing, if let's say a journalist of color might find herself needing to have a particular lens on race in an overwhelmingly white newsroom because she can see what others might have a blind spot about, regardless of their best intentions. And so for me, it was along lines of class and place that I felt that same sort of responsibility to say, hey, these stories are being missed, and I'm going to show you how I know in the most personal and intimate way. And those essays, Rob, are the things that went viral, and I found that in this kind of information saturated media ecosystem, people are still really longing for deep personal connection. And so I just kind of wear my heart on my sleeve now in a lot of my writing. And I've found that it helps people find not just the data and the facts of a story, but the meaning of what's going on in this country.
In your new essay collection and elsewhere, you talk sometimes about how your own ideas and perspectives about rural America have changed. Reflecting back, what are some of the things where Sarah Smarsh has changed her thoughts about how rural America works and what it means?
Sure. You know, I mentioned that I grew up in kind of Reagan. It was a Reagan era childhood and then like a Clinton era adolescence in rural and small town Kansas, growing up on a fifth generation wheat farm. And it felt sort of like an apolitical existence. My people largely didn't vote. We were working in fields, like just trying to survive while other people were discussing politics and reading headlines, and that sort of classic chasm between, let's say, the chattering class and the people working on the ground. I nonetheless sort of absorbed a vague moderate conservatism, I would say, when I showed up as a first generation student on the University of Kansas campus. I've probably thought of myself as maybe like fiscally conservative and socially liberal. As my information sources expanded and, you know, I took some sociology classes, let's say, on the impact that one's place of origin and identity have on life outcomes, statistically speaking, I thought, well, gosh, where affirmative action sounded unfair to me, you know, coming into that debate, now that I've got some information about why it's potentially a course corrective by way of policy, it sounds right as rain to me. And that's not to suggest, by the way, Rob, that one needs to go to college to somehow be open to liberal ideas or expand their awareness. I will say what never changed, though, and this is why I caution people against not only assuming that someone from a particular place or identity thinks and believes in a certain way, but even I would caution against assuming that someone who ascribes to a particular political label is, a quote unquote good or bad person. Here's what I say, and I hope this comes across in my writing. Some ideas are superior to others. I would caution, though, all of us, if we are, let's say, fortunate to have found our way to what are indeed superior ideas, perhaps it's not because we ourselves are superior, but because our life experience and exposure to ideas have allowed us to find a better ideology.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That was author and journalist Sarah Smarsh. She's giving a lecture in Spring Green on August 20th. You can find information about that lecture and a write-up of this conversation at WPR.org.